This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. There's a new governor and legislature in Raleigh, and that means a whole new stable of people running important government departments like transportation and environment and natural resources. It also means appointments to important boards that regulate utilities, schools, and higher education. And in Charlotte, Bank of America continues to spend billions of dollars to clean up bad mortgages. Also, an ex-governor looks to reclaim his law license, and the Wilmington 10 are finally innocent in the eyes of the law. Today, we're talking about those North Carolina stories and more with a panel of reporters. John Frank is a politics and government reporter with the News and Observer in Raleigh. Julie Rose is a reporter at WFAE in Charlotte, and Dave DeWitt, a reporter right here at WUNC in Durham. Welcome to all of you. Good to have you here.
Thanks.
Hi, Frank.
Hi, Frank.
Durham, Chapel Hill, and Raleigh, I should say, the whole triangle. And Dave, let's start with you. In one of her last acts as governor, Bev Perdue pardoned the Wilmington 10. Other than the fact that they are now innocent officially, what does that do?
Well, one of the interesting aspects of that, and there were many, was that she chose to give them a pardon of innocence. And a governor can do three different kinds of pardons: pardon of forgiveness, pardon of innocence, or unconditional pardon. And the pardon of innocence is important because that's the state no longer believes that these people committed this crime. And when she made the pardon of innocence, nobody came out and said that they disagreed with this decision except the original prosecutor, a guy named Jay Stroud, who has since been disbarred and sort of had all kinds of things come out recently. The latest was a sort of slate of documents that showed that he may have been sort of racially profiling potential jurors. So this was in some ways an easy decision by the governor, but in some ways a more difficult, because whenever you pardon somebody, it's going to get a lot of people upset. But in this case, it didn't at all. And so one of the other interesting aspects is there's always politics behind it. Like I said, in talking to the people who were really pushing for this pardon, a lot of them believed that if Governor Perdue didn't do this, that they had a really good chance with Governor McCrory coming in and potentially granting this pardon as a way of sort of and that would have been a much more political decision on his part, or calculated political decision on his part. He likes to say he's a pretty moderate centrist governor. He ran the city of Charlotte that way, certainly. And this could have been an opportunity for him to show that he was going to be a moderate type governor. So
help
from that
him build a base in African American communities, perhaps.
Certainly, he certainly would have appealed to a lot of folks that maybe traditionally Republicans don't appeal to.
Yeah.
So in that way, it was an interesting political decision. It was made 5 days before she left office. She said all the right things about how it was egregious miscarriage of justice, even used the term that this trial was tainted by naked racism. So it was a pretty unconditional pardon of innocence.
A trial that was political from beginning to end, apparently. John, the big story this week, of course, the inauguration of Pat McCrory, the swearing in. But a bigger story, it seems to me, is one you reported this morning. McCrory's cabinet members are getting some nice raises over their Democratic predecessors.
They are. The total salary for McCrory's cabinet is now $1.1 million. It's about an average of an 8% increase over his predecessor, Governor Bev Perdue. And some of those are big. At least four cabinet secretaries received pay hikes as large as $13,200. That's an 11% increase. Wow. Four others received a 5% increase, about $6,000-$7,000.
So how much discretion does the governor have over these salaries?
This was never an issue before this. The cabinet secretary's salary used to be set in state law, but the Republican legislature last year changed that law to give the governor complete discretion. He can set them wherever he wants. And McCrory explained to me the other day that he set them in tiers based on the size of the agency's budget. But I think what's filling up my email inbox and making this one of the most commented stories on the News Observer's website today is possibly McCrory's quote about this, which includes, he wants to make sure they can, quote, afford to live as they're running these budgets. And that rings quite hollow to the average state employee who's seen a 1.2% increase in the last 4 years.
I was going to say, the top folks are getting far larger increases than the rank and file folks mm-hmm. who are actually carrying out all these policies. The average state worker's getting nothing near that, right?
No. State workers hadn't had a pay raise until last year for 4 years. And last year it was only 1.2%. Dana Cope, the executive director of the State Employees Association, told me that he hopes the cabinet secretary's raises represent a rising tide that lifts all ships and not just the one with the captain in it.
Well, I was going to say, just knowing that your boss got a big raise doesn't float my boat.
Yes.
But I guess we'll have to wait and see. You know, it's like those big athletes who say they turn down the $13 million for the $14.5 million to leave your city because they were thinking of their families.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting here from McCrory because he's been going around the state saying money won't fall out of the sky. We're not going to have a lot of extra money for this spending priority or that spending priority. And then for him to do this, some people think that seems a little hypocritical. Also on the campaign trail, you emphasized his thriftiness and his fiscal restraint. So I think that's why this is really ringing a chord here in politics today.
Julie Rose of WFAE, mm-hmm. Pat McCrory, former mayor of Charlotte. That's a position that doesn't usually find itself in the governor's mansion. Are the folks in Charlotte looking forward to McCrory's tenure?
Well, they are, of course. They feel like this is their guy. This is Mayor Pat. I mean, he was here, I don't know, was it yesterday, the day before yesterday for his open house saying, call me Mayor Pat, that's fine. I'm still your mayor. You know, I'm still happy. I'm still proud of what we did out here in Charlotte. It's funny what, you know, John talking about his story today with the pay. I think part of what has always kind of been McCrory's calling card during his time as a mayor in Charlotte was his... I guess the perception that he's a business guy. He's friendly to business. He spent 28 years working at Duke Energy, although he has spent the last basically 20 years as a politician more than anything. But you know, the business community here is really, they see him as finally we got our business guy in Raleigh, in the governor's mansion. And you know, you often hear from people who come from the business side that, you know, it's important to get the best people in office, that we pay them, you know, enough to attract the best people from business. So, I guess I'm not entirely surprised to see McCrory, who, you know, comes from that kind of a mindset about we got to take the best lessons we can from business, offering something of a pay boost to the people that he's taking from business to run some of his secretary.
Yeah, and apparently
positions.
He's finding some of the best people for the job at his former employer, Duke Energy. And you filed a piece this week on the possibility that one of those people from Duke Energy might end up on a public utility commission. There are four openings, right, on that commission. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, there will be in the next 6 months, there will be three vacant commission seats of the seven commissioners. And then also, perhaps even more importantly in many people's eyes, the public staff, the executive director of the public staff of the Utilities Commission, Robert Gruber, is retiring after 30 years in that position. That's a governor's appointee as well. And that's a critical position because he's the consumer advocate. So every time Duke or Progress or Dominion comes forward and says, we want to raise rates this amount, it's the public staff's job to make sure you and I and all the industrial customers and the commercial customers that sort of were represented in that negotiation. He's the one that's supposed to push back. And, you know, these appointments are the governor gets to choose who he wants. And his spokesman says he is not going to rule out doing what he has in a couple of other positions already, appointing somebody who spent all or most of their career at Duke Energy.
Well, let's listen to what Chris Walker, the governor's spokesman, said when you put that question to him.
I don't think he wants to limit any type of individual based on any type of preconceived notion. He wants to make sure that we have the best possible people in all these positions.
John Frank, when you talk about that, I'm going to get back to Julie in a second when I ask John Frank about this from somebody who's covering this in Raleigh. Yeah, you leave it open, the best possible people, but does conflict of interest play a part in this? If you worked at Duke Energy and now are chief of staff of the commission that oversees Duke Energy, are those people considered disqualified because of their position?
That's the obvious fear. I mean, McCrory's deep ties to Duke Energy, regardless of who he appoints, are making some groups uncomfortable. The AARP, in addition to NC Warren, has asked McCrory to recuse himself from making utilities commission appointments. That's a big deal, especially for AARP to be on there. And it's not just NC Warren, which is a very voice versus advocate. And this is a question McCrory is going to face throughout his tenure. I mean, his long years at Duke Energy and then the fact he's got two or three Duke Energy folks on his cabinet or in top posts has some folks worried.
Julie, what kind of reaction did you get when you did your piece for WFAE about the reaction to the possibility of somebody from Duke Energy on that commission?
Well, I mean, it's, I guess, the same concerns that NC Warren and the AARP and consumer groups raise, which is, you know, how can we have the fox watching the hen house? But, you know, there also is a lot of people said to me, look, when the commission, people need to keep in mind, sort of on the other side of this argument, people need to keep in mind that, first of all, the legislature is going to have to approve whoever Governor McCrory nominates, although he does have a Republican legislature. So, you know, they may just nominate, agree to whoever he nominates. But the other piece is that the commission itself, those three people he'll be appointing, they are really not like a county commissioner or a town commissioner where they get to take political donations and spend a lot of time like debating policy and changing it and tweaking it and that kind of stuff. Like, they're really more like a court of appeals judge. So there is a whole sort of whoever gets appointed to that job is held to certain standards to sort of hold themselves apart and be an impartial judge. Now, if you spent your whole career inside Duke Energy, you have a certain potential bias that obviously will create some serious scrutiny and concern, I'm sure, if that becomes a situation that Governor McCrory walks into.
On the State of Things today, we're taking a look at the week's news from around the state with John Frank, a politics and government reporter with the News and Observer in Raleigh. Julie Rose is a reporter at WFAE in Charlotte. Dave DeWitt, a reporter here at WNC. And our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, rounding up the news from around the state, talking about it with John Frank, a politics and government reporter with the News and Observer in Raleigh. Julie Rose is a reporter at WFAE in Charlotte. Dave DeWitt here at WUNC. So we're talking about some of the news, people getting jobs in the McCrory administration. One opening soon will be the chair of the State Board of Education. Talk about that position and how important it is.
Well, right now it's being held by Bill Harrison, who was appointed by Governor Perdue. And if you remember, when he was appointed, Governor Perdue gave him some duties that were typically held by the state superintendent of public instruction at the time, and still June Atkinson. And that created June Atkinson didn't like it, and she went to court and got those duties back. So it does show you within the same party that there can be some disagreements about how to run an institution like the Department of Public Instruction. But, you know, those two have worked publicly very well together. You know, at least from what we can tell, they've done a really they've worked in concert, have a generally the same ideas about how things should be run. That is unlikely to be the case moving forward when Bill Harrison leaves and a new state board chair comes in. It will be an interesting appointment, like all of these are. But that one, you know, the State Department of Public Instruction is the largest thing that the state does. It's the largest thing that the state runs. And it'll be fascinating to see who gets appointed, because the legislature has some very strong ideas on changes that should be made. Governor McCrory has shown a little less interest in specific education topics and controversies. So, you know, I think you'll see whoever gets that job, you know, where that person comes from, what they believe in, the things that changes they want to make. We'll see sort of who is going to be running public education for the next 4 years or so. Will it be the legislature? Will it be the governor? In the past, it's always been very strongly Democratic governors have a very strong interest in education. It'll be interesting to see if Pat McCrory has that same interest.
Well, and John, one of the reasons that Bill Harrison is still the State Board of Education chair is because the Senate Republican leaders declined in the last session to reappoint board members whose terms had expired. Why was that?
It was essentially a filibuster, like we see in Washington. They wanted to wait for the new governor to come in and make his own recommendations and put Republicans ostensibly on the board. It's going to be interesting. House Speaker Tom Tillis, a Republican from the Charlotte area, told me this week that education is his number one priority. Now, he and the Senate leader, Phil Berger, disagreed on this topic last session. And as Dave mentioned, McCrory is kind of a wild card out there without getting into specifics on the campaign trail. So how this develops is going to be really interesting to watch. And we could see some major changes when it comes to education this year.
What kind of changes? What might we expect, Dave?
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of conversation. Obviously, the old conversation was always about charter schools. And that one's sort of already gone away, because with new charter schools coming in, I think they got applications of intent for more than 150. I think it was 167 or so of letters of intent of people who want to start charter schools. Obviously, the cap has always been at 100 until this point. So you're going to see that. You're going to see conversations about tax credits for people going to private schools or charter or private schools, pretty much. And whether those tax credits might go to individuals, will they go to companies? You'll see a lot more business activity in the public school system. You know, charter schools are oftentimes run by for-profit companies. The online charter school conversation that's going on now centers around a company called K-12, a for-profit company. So you're going to see a lot of those conversations occur, both in K through 12 education, and then a lot more conversations going on about higher education as well.
Maybe more out-of-state students?
Maybe more out-of-state students. Maybe, you know, the central conversation in higher education, I think, is going to be interesting. And a lot of it has to do with this UNC Advisory Committee on Strategic Decisions that has been formed and given the draft report. That conversation is going to be centered really on, should the UNC system be about preparing students to work in the workforce? Or should it be about preparing students in a more holistic way, liberal arts education and being able to write and think critically and that way change careers quite a bit as things move on? And as you would expect, a lot of the more conservative folks, pro-business folks, believe that the system should be in place to develop students for the workforce. And a lot of the current higher education folks, people who work in and around it, believe it should be more of a liberal arts education, taking into effect all the things of technology and all the things that are going to change education. That's really the central discussion that all the other things, I think, will come out of.
John, the speaker Tillis may have said education is his most important priority, but there are others. What's some of the other legislation, big bills that we can expect making their way through the legislature?
Well, the biggest bill and possibly the first one is a voter ID measure. Republicans, Tillis and McCrory, softened their stance a little bit this week, saying they may not require a photo voter ID, which was a major campaign promise from the party this fall, and allow other documents, maybe just a voter registration card or possibly even a utility bill or some kind of other government document with your name and address on there. That's going to be interesting to watch. The other big one right out of the gate is the unemployment insurance issue. Republicans have already drafted legislation to curtail benefits for unemployed workers. This is a big deal given the state's still high unemployment rate.
Much higher than the national average at the moment.
Yes, definitely.
So those are a couple of things to keep on our radar. I want to move off of politics for a second, Julie, and talk with you because earlier this week, Bank of America announced it reached yet another multi-billion dollar settlement in its effort to get out from under those bad mortgages. Give us a story. What's the latest now in its negotiations and the settlement with the federal government?
Right. Well, these settlements this week bring the total settlements for Bank of America since 2009 to over $40 billion. And there are more to come. So it's but this countrywide financial acquisition, which happened 5 years ago today, in fact, is really kind of the headache that just will not go away for Bank of America. These turned out to be incredibly toxic mortgages that have incredible default rates. And so the settlement, the big one for Bank of America this week, was with Fannie Mae. That's the government-backed agency, basically, that buys mortgages from banks so that they can then turn around and make more loans. So it kind of frees up the cash at the bank. Now, Fannie Mae has argued for a couple of years that they were sold a whole bunch of really ugly mortgages under false pretenses during the countrywide years, and that Bank of America should have to buy those back because of essentially like a breach of contract. You know, you told us these were good mortgages. They turn out to stink. You know, you owe us. Take these back. We don't want them. And by the way, make up what we lost. So Bank of America agreed to $10 billion. $3.5 billion of that is payment directly to Fannie Mae. And then the other $6.75 is buying back mortgages off of Fannie's books.
Any idea? Any idea how much of this actually goes to home buyers? Does anybody get to stay in their house because of the settlement? Or does
no,
this...
no, no, not on that one. Not on that one at all. But I mean, other than sort of in potentially the bigger picture, you know, if this makes Fannie Mae healthier, if it makes, I don't know, Bank of America's, if it helps Bank of America like clear some problems off of its books, that potentially makes it more able to, you know, issue more mortgages in a healthier fashion. But when you talk about foreclosures specifically, that's the other settlement that happened this week. And that was the settlement between federal regulators and 10 banks, including Bank of America, that addresses foreclosures. And I don't know if you remember the robocall debacle. Mm-hmm. I mean, robo-signing debacle. Right. So this is where you know, the banks were apparently, allegedly, and now it's been proven that they were, you know, signing off on foreclosures just en masse without any real, without the proper review. And so, a year and a half ago, they agreed to a review of their files to make sure, you know, to catch the ones where the problems had occurred and to then address, help those homeowners. Well, that's been going on for like a year and a half to almost 2 years, and is just really not producing the kind of results that regulators wanted, nor is it going fast enough for them. So this settlement brings an end to that whole foreclosure review process that turned out not to work. And this does actually provide $3.3 billion total for the 10 banks. $3.3 billion will go to compensate almost like a class action type approach, you know, where if you were in foreclosure in 2009, 2010, you should get some sort of a payment between a couple hundred dollars and maybe $125,000. If you lost your home, that's probably pretty small comfort, but at least it'll kind of resolve that issue. And then there also is about $6 billion that'll go toward paying down principal and other mortgage relief efforts for people who are still in their homes currently.
And of course, the interesting question you pointed to that this raises is the federal government is saying, look, we're not getting anywhere fast. People are suffering. Let's do it. On the other hand, there are people who are saying, yeah, but the settlement you got comes nowhere near the amount of damage that was done.
Precisely. I mean, it's really there's no way to make good all of the damage that was done. And the banks are eager to just get beyond this. And, you know, Bank of America, especially with its huge. I mean, they have the lion's share of the really messed up mortgages that people just are foreclosing on and are in arrears on and so forth, the defaulting loans. And you're right. I mean, the government on the one hand wants to maintain some stability, wants to see justice done. But, you know, the other big settlement that we've got ongoing is the one that was signed by attorneys general and actually led by North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper, with Bank of America and a couple of other servicers, that does a lot of the same things that this foreclosure one did this week. And that is, again, supposedly we're starting to see some actual aid going to homeowners in the form of principal reduction, in the form of helping these homeowners to modify their mortgages, or in some cases be able to sell the home for less than it's worth, but not have to swallow that whole loss themselves, have the banks cover some of that. So,
now, what does this do for the health of Bank of America itself? On the one hand, it's a lot of money to have to pay out. On the other, I would think that at this point, and maybe you can tell me, does this last round of settlements make things more certain for investors? So it costs a lot, but at least we know how much it's going to cost, and therefore, you know, Bank of America may look like a better investment.
Exactly. But Bank of America actually led led North Carolina public companies, as well as the financial industry, I believe, the major banks, at least, in terms of the increase in its share price over 2012, which, you know, I mean, it's still like, I think it's around less than $10, right, compared to the 40 something it was once upon a time. So it's still got a long ways to climb. But this was a good year for investors starting to feel a little bit more like, OK, we feel like maybe Bank of America is getting kind of to the end of its nightmare. And this does, I mean, some analysts did tell me that seeing these settlements, they sort of put a price structure on the additional risk that the bank is exposed to. And each one of these chips away a little bit more of that unknown. And that's what investors really do not like. So there are more and more looking to think, I mean, everyone pretty much agrees in the industry that Bank of America is way undervalued right now at its current price level. It's just a matter of when it's ever going to get back to something closer to what it's worth. And so we did see a lot more investors this year thinking, yeah, OK, maybe I'm willing to kind of get in at this point because I know a little more about what the risks are.
John Frank, I wonder if any of this is obviously Bank of America's problem and to that extent Charlotte's problem, depending on how well Bank of America does and how it comes out of this. Is any of this grist for the legislature? Do they need to weigh in on any of this?
We'll likely to see some action on this. Bank of America, as Wells Fargo, too, has a big lobbying presence in Raleigh. The House just put Ruth Samuelson, a Charlotte Republican, in charge of the banking committee. So if there is anything, we're likely to see it to be very friendly toward that industry. Representative Samuelson has some political ambition. She's one of the Republican leaders in the House, and I think we could see her run for even higher offices at some point. So, and Bank of America and Wells Fargo are big financiers. So on the political side, I think we'll see these two entities work together this year.
Let's talk about some other issues and stories in the news. Word this week that Mike Easley wants to get his law license back. Why, Dave?
I think he needs a job. I think, you know, he went through a legal process himself after he was out of office, was convicted, the first governor ever to be convicted of a crime. So, you know, he went back down to Southport and hung out a little bit, probably waited as long as he felt like he could. But I think he needs a job. I think he probably needs to do some things that will help provide an income. He wasn't any, you know, he was a public servant before he came in to the governorship. He wasn't somebody who came from private business and had a lot of money. So it may be a situation where he needs to work.
And this is not really a I mean, it's a political decision, but it's outside of the legislature. This would be something for the state bar to decide, isn't that?
It is. Easley has law license suspended for a year, and as part of the settlement, in that he wouldn't be disbarred, they said he had to reapply, and that's what the change in law allows. So he's filed those papers. We'll go through that. On the political side, I think Republicans are happy to see this in the headlines as long as it takes it. It reminds voters again why they voted Republican in the last couple elections, possibly because they're tired of some of these Democratic scandals from Governor Easley and Governor Perdue's campaign finances. So on the political side, this is good for Republicans, and I think Democrats just want to get it over with.
Talk about some other things around the state. Julie, since it was first proposed, NASCAR Hall of Fame in Charlotte has been a bit of a point of contention. It has not drawn the kind of crowds and revenues, at least those are the stories we've been seeing, that it needed to kind of justify the public funding that went into it. Has the NASCAR Hall of Fame, you should pardon the expression, turned a corner?
Well, there are some signs that things, I don't know, that the future may not be quite so grim, but for reasons that you might not expect. So just quickly, I mean, the city spent about $200 million building this Hall of Fame, which the city owns and operates through its Convention and Visitors Bureau. And all of that debt is being paid off by hotel and restaurant taxes, essentially. And then there's an operating, it's been running $1 million at least, deficit these last 2 years. And the real problem was that everybody said sort of in the heat of the moment, we're going to get 800,000 people a year come into this place. Well, even in the first year when everybody was really excited back in 2010, only 272,000 people came. So way, 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 way short of original projections. And now really actually realizing that visitors themselves are not so far going to be enough to actually get this thing paid for and to cover its expenses. So what's been very interesting is that just in the last couple of months, we've come to learn from the Convention and Visitors Authority that it's actually the thing that's bringing in the most money, actually helping the Hall of Fame for the first time ever in its history run ahead of budget. It's $80,000 ahead of what it projected to be for the first 6 months of this fiscal year. And what's doing that, believe it or not, is actually people who want to hold events at the Hall of Fame. So the city has realized that, you know, this is a kind of a cool venue for a bachelor party or a wedding reception or a corporate luncheon. And that's where they're really focusing their sales efforts on conventions that come to town and want a cool backdrop for an event. And it looks as though it's going to be that, if anything, that will help the NASCAR Hall of Fame eventually pay its own bills.
But even that, I would assume the turnaround in the economy might have had something to do with that as well.
Sure, sure. As things improve, I mean, it is a pretty expensive ticket. It's $18, I think, for kids even to come see the Hall of Fame if you're going to pay a ticket. And, you know, the DNC being here in Charlotte was helpful, too, for the last 6 months, certainly, in terms of boosting its revenues. But I think people have been really worried that, look, we're not getting nearly the visitors we thought we would be. And here the city, I mean, NASCAR Hall of Fame is a really bad word in city council meetings out here in Charlotte. Really? Because for those that still remain on the council, there are a couple of them who voted for this thing. They feel like they were sold a bill of goods. They really bought into something that is an albatross around their necks. And they, more than anything, are like, we have to make good on this. We have to find a way that this does not cost the taxpayers any more than it already has. And so there's some desperation to figure out how do we get more people to come here? And marketing so far hasn't really boosted the attendance numbers. But loosening their food and beverage rules so that you can have more banquets and receptions and cocktail parties inside the museum area itself, That seems to be doing the trick right now. So they're really hoping.
They found a way. Well, Dave, let's take one last look at sports before we close out. National Hockey League has ended its lockout. I don't know if anybody's noticed, but they're on the ice.
There are definitely a few people who noticed, and they're focused around the PNC Arena in Raleigh. You know, it's big not only for the players, obviously, and it being sort of the Triangle's only major professional sport, but there are a lot of folks who work the games, who not only just sort of work outside and parking and tickets and everything else, that are on a contract basis, who, you know, they were hurting. There's no doubt about it. There's not a whole lot of businesses around the PNC Arena, which is why you have such an interesting hockey tailgating situation that goes on at those games. But there are a lot of folks who suffered greatly. And we're not talking about the multimillion-dollar players or the billionaire owners. We're talking about the folks who, you know, were working in the arena and around the arena for those games, who obviously are pretty pleased, even with a shortened season with, you know, I think just more than half the games they would have had. This is pretty good news for those folks.
Kane's going to win the cup?
No.
Okay. Dave DeWitt, reporter here at WUNC. Thank you. Thank you. Julie Rose, a reporter at WFAE in Charlotte, and John Frank, politics and government reporter for the NNO in Raleigh. Thank you all for being on the show.
Thanks again.
You're welcome.
Thanks.
Coming up, the music of Ironing Board Sam. You got to stay tuned.